Welcome to the TARDIS Library, a place to talk comics, novels, audios and more from the worlds of Doctor Who.
G'day everyone, Rob here, and welcome to another edition of the TARDIS Library. Look, if I'm being honest, I thought I would have been talking to you a little earlier in the month, but it's been quite busy, so my apologies we haven't come back with more reviews of late. In this particular episode, we have both Mike Solko and myself, Mike, on Big Finish duty, of course, and I'll be talking about the final part of the Titan Comics Third Doctor comic by Paul Cornell. And because this is not only the final part of that comic series, but also the last thing Paul Cornell will ever do in Doctor Who, well, for the time being at least, I've really gone to town on that review. So I've made some notes, and I think I'll psych myself up for them while Mike talks to you about Big Finish, and I'll return after that to talk Third Doctor and Paul Cornell.
Hi, this is Mike, back to talk about Big Finish Audios again, and I'm going to be discussing two stories this month, the first of which is from the main range. It's number 222, The Contingency Club. It's written by Phil Mulrine and directed by Barnaby Edwards, who also directed last month's story, The Starmen, which was written by Andrew Smith. And while I was really enjoying The Starmen last month, this story kind of didn't really hit the mark for me. I'm not a big fan of the Fifth Doctor era to begin with, which makes it a little bit difficult for me to get into the stories. It's not so much the Fifth Doctor I have a problem with as it is his companions, typically. Turlough I tend to enjoy, and Nyssa can be okay in the right story, but with Tegan and with Adric, there's a lot of bickering. And the word banter is thrown around at least once or twice in this story, and it's interesting because conflict is okay among a TARDIS team for me, but when that banter just becomes bickering without a real point, it gets really frustrating. It doesn't feel like it's developing the characters, it just feels obnoxious. And when you have Tegan and Adric interacting, most often it does become a case of bickering. There is one point of interaction with them early in the story that does come up later on, and it is key, and it's actually a pretty clever trick. But for the most part, it's just a lot of running around in this story. So to give you the background, the Contingency Club is a gentleman's club set in the late 19th century of England. And if you were a man in that era, and you were a man of society who wanted to have any kind of standing, you would be a member of a club such as this, a gentleman's club. And what's interesting is the TARDIS is pulled off course, which is kind of it's a cliche that you hear quite a bit in these stories, but it's a worthwhile cliche. It sets the crew and they're kind of trapped. And so this TARDIS is on the way to Heathrow. They're trying to get Tegan home yet again, and it gets pulled off course into this gentleman's club called the Contingency Club, where it promptly loses all power. So the team has to go out and they have to try to figure out what's going on. And almost immediately, it's interesting because you have these men in the club who are acting very bizarrely. They don't even seem to recognize that Tegan and Nyssa are female. So you don't really know what's going on in this club. So while they're finding out about this mystery, they end up getting trapped in the club by the man who is the head maitre d' or leader of this club. And it's interesting because there's a group of characters called the Edwards. And Edward is a character that shows up first as a servant. He's played by the actor Ollie McCauley. And then all of a sudden, you see that there's more than one Edward. Apparently there's a group of Edwards running around who are all of the servants at this contingency club. It's one of the most clever bits of the story, and I really enjoyed the performance of Edward, be it individually or as a group. And Ollie found a way to play those characters in a differing manner, which is difficult because when you're playing multiple characters in the same story that are the same character, bringing that differentiation in takes a lot of skill. So much credit to him as being one of the unique pieces of this story. Quickly, the characters interact with a character named Marjorie, who is trying to find her father. He was abducted into the club or joined the club, but basically has disappeared at this point, and she cannot gain access as a female to the gentleman's club, and that's why she's trying to get away in. You also meet a character named George Augustus, who is a gentleman of society, but maybe not a gentleman of high standing, who is an investigator as well. So he's trying to get access to the club, and it seems like it's because he wants to be a member, and he's very turned off by not being allowed to be a part of it, but it seems like he's also interested in the mystery of what the Contingency Club is and why it is. So any story is defined by its big bad, and in this case you've got a character named the Red Queen. She's played by Lorelei King, who's a very famous American voice actress. She's done quite a bit of audio work in the past, and unfortunately her performance comes across as a bad Catwoman pastiche if you think back to the old Batman 1960s series. It's very vamping, it's very silly, just very over the top, and it just doesn't bring the sense of menace that this story really needs to succeed. So that was a frustrating point for me as well. She might be very good in other parts, it's just this particular part didn't hit the mark. So the Red Queen is very interested in games. And there's obviously some tricks she's up to with this contingency club of hers, but you're not quite sure of what the game is and what the larger end game will be. That does play out over the story, and it's interesting, but it's not really anything fantastic. For the most part, you really just have characters running around through secret passages, tunnels. You've got a horse chase with two carriages, and you get the horses on cobblestones, things like that. So it does evoke the era it's set in, and the direction is very solid. The sound effects are very solid. The music fits the era. But again, there's nothing about this story that in any way grabs the listener or says, this is a worthwhile use of your time. If it was a story that was on Doctor Who, it's a story that would really fall in the middle. It's not bad, it's not terrible in any way, but there's no background characters that really stand out as very interesting for the most part. The Doctor and his companions don't really have much character development. You get a few hints then here and there about Adric and his willingness to sacrifice himself, and of course that foreshadows what we see later in the TV series, but there's just not anything here that really is going to stand out and really wow you. So if you could get it on sale, it's probably worth it, but it's not something that's really worth going out of your way to pick up, which is too bad. If I was to rank it on a scale of 1 to 10 Edwards, I would give it a 5.5. I know I haven't really done halves yet, but I feel bad giving it less than a 6, but at the same time, it's really not much better than middling, so let's go with 5.5 Edwards out of 10. Now, on a sad note, but a more interesting note as far as stories go, I listened to the first volume of The War Doctor, which was called Only the Monstrous, and I'm going to discuss the very first story called The Innocent. Now, the entire box set is directed by Nicholas Briggs, who also wrote it. And of course, if you know much about Big Finish, you know Nicholas Briggs is one of the main writers, one of the main directors of the range, as well as being the voice of the Daleks on TV, as well as many other monsters. Briggs has been involved with fandom and productions, gosh, going back, I mean, to the 80s. He's someone very knowledgeable about Who, and he usually brings something new to it when he approaches a story. Coming to The War Doctor, it's interesting because aside from what we've seen in the TV movie, and maybe a comic book short scene here and there, the character is a blank slate for the most part. So what are you going to do with that character to develop him? One of the first things is they introduce a character named Cardinal Alistra, and she's played by Jacqueline Pierce, who is most famous for playing Servalon on the series Blake 7, but she appeared in The Two Doctors, a story in the Sixth Doctor era with Patrick Troughton as well, and she played Chassini, who was one of the villainous characters. And that's really what she does well, is she plays characters who are kind of vampish, kind of sinister to a degree, and she brings that across in this time lady known as Cardinal Alistra. And what's interesting is she's one of the chief strategists for the Time Lords, and she's very frustrated because she can't bring the Doctor under her thumb. They really need the Doctor's help as much as possible during the Time War, which is when this is set, and he's reluctant to help except for on his own terms. So in some ways, he's similar to what we saw with Paul McGann in the movie more than the character we come to know later on. But make no mistake about it, this is a Doctor who's had to make some very difficult choices and has to do so within this story. The Time Lords are under attack from the Daleks, who are massing all of their invasion fleet up against Gallifrey at this point. There's a massive weapon which Gallifrey has brought forth, and I don't want to tell you what it is, but you're going to perk up when you hear it if you're a fan of the classic series. It involves some self-sacrifice, and the Doctor finds a way to sacrifice himself. Everyone believes that he's dead. As it turns out, he's landed on a planet called Kesko, where he's been asleep for over 100 days being tended to by a young woman known as Rejoice. And Rejoice is played by Lucy Briggs Owen. And Rejoice is a character that you desperately want to see join him on his travels, whether they be as the War Doctor or any other Doctor. She's just a very positive figure who's known peace throughout her life, and she grows very attached to the Doctor, and of course he does to her as well throughout this story. She's a character that you see so often throughout Who, which is just one of those characters that would make an excellent companion and you wish they could come along for the ride. This colony of Kesko is very peaceful, and this race is under attack from a race called the Talaeans, who followed them from their original planet. Their urge to wipe this race out is so strong that they followed them to another planet to take care of them. And the Keskans, unfortunately, are very underpowered. They have no real strong defenses to speak of. And here we have a Doctor who has reached a point of where he just wants to go, be forgotten, and find peace. He wants to get away from war, but unfortunately he finds himself drawn into a war that has nothing to do with his own. So the Doctor has to make another tough choice as far as whether he does get involved, to what degree he gets involved, and whether he'll be able to salvage the society in any way that works for them. It's a really beautiful story because it takes so much of what we know about the Doctor, how he reacts to things, and it places on a character that has a moral ambiguity we're not really used to. It's an interesting story to start the set on because even though it takes place during the Time War with the War Doctor, it takes place aside from the Time War for the most part. But it's really critical because it establishes this character and what we can expect from him. How much of the Doctor we know is left, and how much has changed from what we've seen in the past. It's really a beautiful story. It's just incredibly well done. And there is no doubt that no matter what choices he might make in this story, the War Doctor is the Doctor. John Hurt's performance is just wonderful. It's so much of what we saw on screen. There's that kind of silliness at times, but it's also mixed with a bit of grouchiness and just real exhaustion and just fatigue from the war he's been fighting. But through his relationship he makes with this character Rejoice and the way they bond, you see that it's still the Doctor. I really don't want to say too much else about this story, except for to say that the final scene will be very heart-wrenching, and it'll kind of evoke a story from the end of another Doctor's era. And I don't want to say much more than that, but this is a Doctor who doesn't necessarily want to fight. He wants to help his people and help the universe escape the evil of the Daleks, but I think he really doubts the ways that the Time Lords and the Gallifreyans are fighting the fight as well. So that's where Jacqueline Pierce does a fantastic job, and again, Lucy Briggs Owen does great, great work. So really, it's tough for me to put a number value on this story because, while it might not be perfect, it is nearly perfect. If I was to rank it on a scale of 1 to 10 Daleks, it would get 9 Daleks out of 10. And as we know, 1 Dalek is enough to take out a fleet of Cybermen, so that's a pretty strong recommendation. Going back to the first story we discussed this month, The Contingency Club, maybe about a 5.5 out of 10, this one gets a 9 out of 10. If you have a chance to pick up this War Doctor set, do so. It is powerful, it is wonderful, and it will make you really feel fond memories of the actor John Hurt, which, of course, we are so lucky to have had him as a part of Doctor Who. So I'll be back next month with Zaltus, which is the next Fifth Doctor story, as well as something else probably that I'll pull from my hat. Thanks, and catch you soon.
Change is a part of life. Change is life itself. If I've been trying to hold on too long to a moment, to a place, or even my friends, well, then I've been guilty of what Salamander accused me of holding my world in stasis, of not trying new things and letting myself grow. Then you run the risk of just doing what's expected of you, of looking at yourself in the mirror and seeing nothing. Or you can experiment, take a risk, honour the familiar with one last hurrah, perhaps, then leave the familiar behind and go forward into the future. These are the words of the Doctor in the fifth and final issue of the Third Doctor comic, but they're really echoing writer Paul Cornell's farewell to the world of Doctor Who. I mean, you just hear it there, you know, honour the familiar with one last hurrah perhaps, then leave the familiar behind, etc., etc. It's interesting, I guess, that as the Doctor says them, the pictures we're seeing on screen, as it were, Salamander escaping from the prison he's been confined in. Perhaps suggesting that Cornell has felt confined by Doctor Who? I don't know. Sometimes you can take an allegory too far, but I found that quite interesting that as these beautiful words, this last hurrah with Doctor Who is playing out, we do see someone escaping a prison. But more on the comic in a moment. Paul Douglas Cornell was born on the 18th of July, 1967, and his professional writing career began in 1990, age 23, when he was the winner in a young writers competition and his entry, Kingdom Come, was produced and screened on BBC Two. Soon after, he wrote Time Worm Revelation, a novel for the Virgin New Adventures series of Doctor Who novels. Time Worm Revelation was itself a reworking of a fan fiction piece Cornell had penned previously for the fanzine Queen Bat. Several other Doctor Who novels followed, of course, including the award-winning Human Nature, which many years after that, of course, would be adapted into a David Tennant TV story. But we're really jumping ahead of things, aren't we? Cornell then began writing for Granada Television, where he wrote for the popular children's medical drama Children's Ward and created his own children's series Wavelength for Yorkshire Television, which ran for two series. He made the crossover to working in adult television full-time in 1996, when he was one of the main contributors to Granada's supernatural soap opera Spring Hill, which ran for 2 years on Sky One and later on Channel 4 in the UK. After a short stint on Coronation Street, Cornell began working for other production companies, including contributing an episode in 1999 to Red Production Company's anthology drama series Love in the 21st Century for Channel 4. His episode, entitled Masturbation, starred Ewan Griffith as Jack. He was due to be one of the writers on Red Production Company's planned Queer as Folk spin-off series Misfits, but the series was never made, being abruptly cancelled by Channel 4. In the 21st century, Cornell has written mainly for the BBC, contributing episodes to all three of their regular medical dramas, Casualty, Holby City, and the daytime soap opera Doctors. He also contributed to the 1950s Sunday evening primetime drama series Born and Bred, and was one of the writers of the 2005 series revival of Doctor Who, writing the episode Father's Day. In 2006, Cornell wrote for the BBC's Robin Hood, produced by Tiger Aspect Productions, for the same Saturday evening family slot as Doctor Who. He also wrote an episode for the second season of another Saturday evening family adventure program, the ITV science fiction series Primeval, transmitted in 2008. Outside of Doctor Who, Cornell has been active in various media, having written 6 Doctor Who novels for Virgin Publishing and BBC Books during the 90s, 3 Doctor Who audio dramas for Big Finish Productions, and a fully animated internet broadcast Doctor Who adventure Screamer the Shulker, starring, of course, Richard E. Grant as the Doctor, for the BBC website back in 2003. He's also written 2 mainstream science fiction novels, Something More and British Summertime, and various novels, short stories, and audio dramas based around a character he later created for the new adventures, Professor Bernice Summerfield, and whom he later licensed to Big Finish Productions. Cornell has also written comics for Doctor Who magazine, the 2000 AD spin-off Judge Dredd magazine, a 6-issue limited series for Marvel Comics called Captain Britain, Young Avengers, Fantastic Four, Action Comics, Batman and Robin, Demon Knights, Stormwatch, and more recently, Saucer Country. In January 2016, Cornell announced his return to television drama when he told followers on his Twitter feed that he had written his first script for US television, contributing an episode to the CBS Sherlock Holmes series Elementary. And, well, I could go on, but I think you get the gist. While some of the people who cut their teeth out there writing Virgin New Adventures have gone on to careers of, well, shall we say, varying visibility, Cornell has been prolific, and he's been out there. And if you ever wanted to catch his next thing, you just needed to stand still in a comic store or a bookshop or near a TV for long enough, and something would turn up. He's that kind of writer. As such, and, you know, just thinking of all that background, it almost doesn't matter what happens in this comic that I'm about to review. It really doesn't, because this is the end of his time in Doctor Who, yes, but it's just one small comic book, you know, when you really boil it down. And even if you put it up against all his other Doctor Who work, or even just his Doctor Who comic work, it can't really hope to compete overall. It is just one comic in a series of 5. I guess what it can try and do is try and wrap up the story it's telling in an entertaining way. And I guess there's some nice scenes with the Master working with UNIT as they confront Salamander. So, you know, there's some wonderful pictures being drawn here with the Delgado Master and Pertwee's Doctor. And obviously Patrick Troughton playing Salamander and Joe Grant and the Brigadier, Benton, Captain Yates, all that sort of stuff. It's really visually quite amazing to look at. And speaking of visually amazing stuff, there's an absolutely bonkers scene as Salamander uses the micro-machine technology we were introduced to in some of the earlier issues. And it sort of comes together to form a sort of a metal sea dragon, and he rides it up the Thames. So one of these comments I was making in an earlier episode, an earlier review, was there are elements of these comics, the Third Doctor comics, that feel like old slippers and very comfortable, and it's like you're watching an Al Pertwee episode, but then something will happen that's quite jarring and is not like what you would see in Pertwee. You know, in the earlier episodes, it was the micro machines themselves and how they looked, and here it's this metallic sea dragon is the best way I can describe it, that, you know, Patrick Troughton or Salamander or whatever you want to call him is riding up the Thames. It's really, really quite bizarre. And there's also a lot of fun. I mean, there's this one scene where Mike Yates is looking out the window of the helicopter. They've been sent back in time to Disraeli-era Britain. And Mike Yates is looking at the lovely countryside, I guess, around London. Hasn't been built up or anything yet. And he starts sort of saying to Joe, you know, it'd be nice to go back, wouldn't it? To go back to a golden age. And, well, get it. I guess newer fans of the show might not get it, but it's a lovely little thing for older fans who have watched the Pertwee era. And yeah, I guess there's even more bonkers stuff as Salamander turns up in Parliament, and Benjamin Disraeli's there, and Salamander's wearing like a sort of a power armor, you know, sort of just outrageous costume, and It's crazy. But not long after that, it's all over. I mean, the Master helps defeat Salamander pretty easily. He uses his hypnotism on the members of Parliament so they don't remember what happened. The Doctor then turns the tables very quickly on the Master because he suspected all along that the Master was up to no good. He wasn't really teaming up with them. And then the Master escapes to fight another day. And that's it. And then it's into the Doctor's speech as they're travelling off in the helicopter. And he addresses that speech about needing to get out there and do new things and whatnot to Joe Grant. So I'll say it. I mean, I'm wanting this to be a real sort of tribute to Paul and you know, to praise the issue as well. But in some ways, it's a bit of a letdown, I guess, that we've got the Doctor and Joe and the Brigadier and Unit and Salamander and Time Travel and Micro Machines and Benjamin Disraeli's Parliament and all of London in that period. And the whole thing is just sewn up in one issue. And very quickly within that issue, I've got to say. It almost feels like there was maybe a 6-part comic here, and for some reason it was only 5 parts. I don't know. It's always hard to say, isn't it, when you're not the writer, but I do think that maybe they could have got to Disraeli's London and maybe there could have been some shenanigans in this episode and then things wrapped up in the next issue, maybe. I don't know. It'd be interesting to know if it was meant to be a 6-part comic. 5 parts is an interesting length often. The comic miniseries I've followed have been like 4-parters or 6-parters. Five is interesting. But anyway, it just feels slightly premature. It doesn't feel like it's fully played enough with the building blocks or the toys in this story, you know, so to speak. So I guess all up, the comic itself is maybe a 9 out of 10 for the imagination, but maybe a 7 out of 10 for the way the story ends. So what's that if we add it together? That's 16 out of 20, so 8 out of 10, which is still a very good mark. It's actually maybe even came out slightly higher than I thought for this particular issue. But overall, across the series, I'd have no problem giving it an 8 out of 10. I think that's a very fair mark because this really was a really great miniseries. But you know what? Even trying to give it a mark like that, it almost doesn't matter because, you know, the passing of Paul from the realm of Doctor Who is a far bigger deal than the story here, you know, or any story that could really be confined to the pages of a comic book like this. Because, honestly, Paul's Doctor Who output is going to be greatly missed. I don't know many people at all who have ever said a cross word about anything he's ever written, which is quite extraordinary when you think of, A, what any kind of fandom is like. There's always someone trying to pick holes in something, and B, what Doctor Who fans are like. But the reception to Paul Cornell, whether it's his like new adventures novels or TV output on the show in the first and second series, I've never seen someone have a crossword about it. But you know what? If there's an upside to him leaving Doctor Who, it's that he's not over it. And I'm sure he'll be, you know, still attending conventions and signing his books and having all manner of fun with fans in the future. I mean, he's a regular at Gallifrey One, which is something we're talking about on a recent episode of the show. And, of course, conventions in the UK. And he strikes me as the kind of guy who's never, ever, ever going to forget where he came from in terms of, you know, Doctor Who giving him quite a leg up in his career. Of course, other things he did gave him a leg up as well, but Doctor Who is obviously one of the big ones. And he's never going to forget that. And you know what? Maybe one day he'll come back. No, I'm not going to do a Hartnell impression. I just wanted to say it might not be part of his plan. It might not be something that's even in his head. It might not be something that even if he does think about it, he's even going to countenance at the moment. But, you know, he might wake up one day, 6 years from now, a dozen years from now, and think, bugger me, I've got a really killer idea for Doctor Who. And he'll pull some strings and call some pals and it'll pop up in a Big Finish audio or maybe a comic book if they're still going, or heaven forbid, maybe even a TV story. That would be great. But I guess it's just not on his mind at the moment. And for now, I think we have to respect that he's moved on. And I'm sure he'd be delighted if fans of his Doctor Who work or his comics work in America and so on would look at his new material, which, you know what, actually starts now. Chalk is his new novel, and I wasn't going to sort of go into any great detail on it, but I do have a description of it which I'd like to read before I finish up here. This is, Andrew Wagoner has always hung around with his fellow losers at school, desperately hoping each day that the school bullies led by Drake will pass him by in search of other prey. But one day they force him into the woods, and the bullying escalates into something more, something unforgivable, something unthinkable. Broken, both physically and emotionally, something dies in Wagoner, and something else is born in its place. In the hills of the West Country, a chalk horse stands vigil over a site of ancient power, and there Wagoner finds in himself a reflection of rage and vengeance, a power and persona to topple those who would bring him low. Paul Cornell plumbs the depths of magic and despair in Chalk, a brutal exploration of bullying in Margaret Thatcher's England. Sounds really good. I think I might have to grab a copy. Paul, I don't know if you're listening. I think in the past you have listened to some of our reviews. Thank you so much for your work on Doctor Who. Thank you for being a prolific storyteller in general. You lead a life that I think many of us dream about, but you do it for real. You lucky man. Thanks again.